Hi, this is Anna East Eden. You're listening to Hollywood and Beyond with your host, Stephen Brittingham. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Hollywood and Beyond with your host, Stephen Brittingham. And that just happens to be me. Wonderful to have all of you here today, friends and listeners. Thank you for listening. This host is very honored to have one of the voices of the Cincinnati Reds as a guest today.
Jay Bruce digging in to start tonight. High drive, left center field, racing back to the wall, Bourgeois. The Reds are National League Central Division champions.
For those of you who might be unaware, I host Hollywood and Beyond here in Cincinnati, Ohio. I grew up in Kettering, Ohio, a suburb of Dayton, just about an hour away from Cincinnati at the most. And Cincinnati is just as much my hometown as Dayton ever was, especially these days. Back somewhere in the late 70s, my grandfather, who along with my grandmother both raised and adopted me, was driving us home one Sunday afternoon, and as usual, I heard two men on the radio with colorful commentary. I asked my dad, "Dad, who are these guys?" Well, that's how it all began, for the joy of baseball was brought into my life. Decades later, while driving my own son home, I was asked a following question about the same two men. "Dad, who are these guys?" Thus, a Reds fan was born, and the tradition of loving the game was handed down to the next generation. And those two men, Marty Brenneman and Joe Nuxhall, or as we affectionately called them here in Cincy, Marty and Joe. My guest today is one of the voices of the Cincinnati Reds, and he primarily provides television play-by-play, often with co-host Chris Welsh, or at times former Reds player Jeff Brantley. And like father, like son, my guest has followed in his dad's footsteps, covering not only Reds baseball, but Fox NFL games. He is a skilled, fun, and colorful announcer, a true professional in every sense of the word, and he is the son of Marty Brenneman, and that would be Tom Brenneman. Tom, welcome to the show, sir.
Stephen, great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's such an honor to be speaking with you today.
Thank you, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, you are most welcome. Your amazing dad, Marty Brenneman, is a native of Portsmouth, Virginia. And then he eventually resided in North Carolina early in his own broadcasting career. You are from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And then North Carolina is a beautiful state. I did theater there years ago in Pinehurst. What was it like growing up with a father who was a broadcaster and so heavily into sports?
Well, I mean, I think it was every kid's dream. You know, when we were bouncing around, he was announcing college sports primarily in small towns in North Carolina. As you mentioned, my sister and I both were born in Chapel Hill while my parents were at the University of North Carolina. When we were real little, I mean, he was just announcing college and high school sports and that kind of thing. And then, you know, when he got a job back in Virginia, in his hometown, to announce the old American Basketball Association, as well as the Triple A franchise of the New York Mets, the Tidewater Tides at the time. I think it was about that age I started to realize, you know, what he did for a living and how cool some of the perks that came along with that, going to the ballpark early, going to the clubhouse, being a bat boy. But, you know, it really all changed when he got the job with the Cincinnati Reds in 1974, and we moved from Virginia to Cincinnati. And, you know, all of a sudden you're walking in a clubhouse in spring training in Tampa, Florida, and you're meeting people like Pete Rose and Johnny Bench and Joe Morgan and Tony Perez and people like that. And I think that's where, and in the subsequent years, you know, I say it all the time. I mean, it was the greatest blessing you could ever ask for, to be around the people that I was around, to meet the people I had an opportunity to meet. Most people just dream about that kind of thing. And I was I certainly didn't call Pete Rose Pete. I called him Mr. Rose, but I was at least on a first name basis. They would call me Tom or Tommy, as they affectionately called me for many, many years and even now. So no complaints whatsoever. It was absolutely fabulous.
No doubt about it. Thank you for that description. So I assume your own interest in sports probably began at a pretty early age yourself.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's really all our family knew. I mean, whether it was going to high school basketball games or college basketball games or later professional basketball games where I ended up being a ball boy for the Virginia Squires in the ABA or being a bat boy during spring training for the Cincinnati Reds and then playing sports myself. Not very good at any of them, I might add, but nonetheless, I enjoyed playing them. And, yeah, sports has always been a huge part of our entire family's lives. There's no doubt about it.
And let's go back, Tom, to that, I believe, first spring training game that you were visiting. And there is quite a scary story, isn't there, where you could have been seriously injured or even worse, and your dad actually saw this happening as he was up in the broadcast booth.
Yeah, I was a bat boy at the time for the Reds in spring training. And, you know, there were a lot of small intricacies that primarily have to do with safety when you're a bat boy. And I obviously was not all that familiar with them. And I walked out into the on-deck circle, a big, strong fellow who played in the major leagues for many, many years, a guy named Roger Freed, was standing in the on-deck circle, and he took this huge swing. And just as he took the swing, I ducked down underneath the bat. And the bat, I could hear the whoosh and, you know, go right by me. And he looked down and he dropped the bat right in the on-deck circle, realizing what could have, thank the Lord above, did not happen. And it was a surreal moment. I can still actually see him almost in slow motion swinging that bat that came passing right over the top of my head. And my dad and I guess his partner, Joe Nuxall, who you mentioned earlier, saw it. And I guess Joe Nuxall was so shaken up by it that he had to actually leave the booth for a minute because it was, I'm sure if you saw it from somewhere else, it was very scary. It was scary to be there, but it happened so quickly, you didn't think much about it. If you were sitting where my dad was sitting, I'm sure it was terrifying. But thank God, everything's all right, and we're sitting here having a conversation today.
That's right. We had a favorable outcome, and no That's doubt right. about it. Being a dad myself, just listening to that story gives me chills because obviously he couldn't do anything to protect you at that moment. And that's probably the worst feeling that a parent probably could ever have. And
no, I don't think there's any doubt. Being a parent myself, I think you've hit the nail right on the head. No doubt about it.
Well, thank you, Tom. And how about a more light-hearted story? I believe that one time when the Reds, of course, were playing in an old Riverfront Stadium, a stadium dear to my heart because that's where my dad would take me to see Reds games. And he never got to see the beautiful park the Reds are in now. But I believe one time you and a friend were having so much fun, you just decided to stay as long as possible. And hey, sometimes we leave somewhere and we leave something behind. But your dad got home and realized that you were still back at a Riverfront Stadium.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, obviously this is long before there was such a thing as cell phones and texting and letting people know where you are and, you know, how you are and all those kinds of things. There was none of that kind of thing going on. And so, yeah, I got left at the ballpark. I guess my dad walked in the house and looked at my mom, and she said, well, where's Tom? And he's like, well, I thought he came home early with a friend. And she's like, I don't think so. And about that time, I remember calling from the Red switchboard. I got to know all the ladies who worked in there and answered the phone. They were open on the switchboard, I think, about an hour and a half after every game. And, sure enough, left his son sitting right there at the old ballpark. But we were safe and sound, so it was no big deal. But I'm sure he heard an earful about it from my mom.
I bet that happened, Tom. No doubt about it. Well, you know, we've mentioned Joe Nuxall several times. I would just love to hear your thoughts on Joe, a former Reds pitcher, and really just a wonderful, wonderful announcer. And I sure do miss Joe today.
Yeah, and for those that don't know, you know, Joe Nuxall to this day was the youngest player in the history of Major League Baseball. It was during World War II, and he was growing up in Hamilton, Ohio, which is a suburb about 25, 30 minutes north of Cincinnati. He was a high school kid, 15 years old, and many of the players were all fighting in the war for the United States at that time, and they had Joe Nuxall at 15 years old pitching a Major League game. We'll never see that again. And then it was 9 years later before he actually got to the major leagues again. He was 24, wound up having a great career with the Reds as a left-handed starting pitcher, spent almost his entire career with the Reds. And then as soon as he retired, he became one of the team's broadcasters. And, you know, for people that are in town, they certainly know what I'm about to say. And you would certainly fit that bill, Stephen. But for those out of town, you know, you could talk about any of the greatest players in the history of the Reds, Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, Frank Robinson, pick whoever you want. I don't think there's ever been a more beloved figure in the history of the Cincinnati Reds franchise, baseball's oldest professional franchise, more beloved than Joe Nuxall. He just had a folksy way about him. He could dine with the King of Kings just hang out and drink a beer up in Hamilton, where he always maintained his home with the guy who was the custodian at the local high school. He was just a beautiful, beautiful man. And when he passed away, there was a part of Cincinnati and all the Reds country that certainly went with him.
Absolutely. Well said, Tom. That's a wonderful and beautiful tribute to Joe. Couldn't have really described him any better. Isn't it amazing, Tom? Today, we couldn't have a person pitch at that age that he did. So that happened at the right time, but it's still amazing, yeah. Isn't it?
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, just to think, you know, for anybody out there that has a sophomore in high school, which is roughly the equivalent of being a 15-year-old, to think about your child participating in a major sporting event professionally. And that's exactly what Joe Nuxall did. The irony is you couldn't do it now and then go back and have your amateur status again. So, you know, if there was a kid that they decided, hey, we think this kid could do it, they couldn't go back and play high school sports ever again or college sports again, because you will have declared yourself basically as a professional player. So it was a different time, and it was a feat that we will never see again.
And your father and Joe had this wonderful chemistry, Tom. They had so much fun together. They both loved the game with all of their heart. And I tell you what, often they would come back from a commercial break and you would hear one of them trying to hold back some laughter. And doubt they must have had some fun times in that booth.
It was an amazing relationship that they had for two men that did not know each other, and they were both well into their adulthood. And I think my dad, when he got the job, was 32, and Joe would have probably been roughly, I don't know, 10 years older than that, maybe a few years older than that. And for the next 35 years, it was just incredible, the relationship they developed. They became the best of friends in the world. And you know, I know there's a part of my dad that misses him every single day, even when he's doing the Reds games, even now in 2018.
Well, I know one thing, Tom. Whenever I go to Great American Ballpark, and let's say it's a beautiful Sunday afternoon, you know, thoughts of Joe do come into my mind. So, you know, someone touched your life when they leave that kind of impact on you. Well,
yeah,
Tom,
I'm
wondering, when did you decide that, hey, I would like to be a broadcaster as well? Did you ever consider going down a different path, or did you know early on that this is what you wanted to do?
No, I really had no idea that's what I wanted to do. I think, you know, I'm often amazed when I'll meet young people now and they'll be a junior or senior in high school and you'll ask them, well, you know, what is it you want to do? And they have some definitive idea exactly what it is they'd like to do. I was never one of those kids. There were a lot of things I was interested in, the law, psychology, veterinarian, all those kinds of things. But I wasn't a particularly great student, and I was, you know, I enjoyed, quite honestly, having more fun with my friends than I did worrying about, you know, my schoolwork. And I mean, it's not like I was a bad student, but I just wasn't a committed, uber committed student. And so I really didn't know what it was that I wanted to do. And I recall, like it was yesterday, I had a deal with my parents, who had, you know, long since divorced, but we had an agreement that said, hey, look, you know, you're going to be one of the kids out there that's extremely blessed and very fortunate in that your parents can afford to send you to college. You're not going to have to take a student loan or anything like that, or borrow money from us and have to pay us back. But having said that, we will never send you money to, you know, go on a date or go to a movie or go have a beer, any of those kinds of things. They said, so here's the deal. You know, either make a ton of money working in the summertime, it'll carry you through the school year, or work in the summer and find a part-time job while you're at college. So that's exactly what I did, both of those. And every summer I used to work down in a place called Nagshead, North Carolina, and lived with my grandparents and worked in a grocery store and all this kind of thing. So I remember at the end of my sophomore year of college at Ohio University, I jumped in the car, and I'd been up for 4 or 5 days, like a lot of people when you're studying for final exams and you're living on coffee and caffeine and all that kind of thing, and you're kind of out of it. And I remember jumping in the car from Athens, Ohio, and starting to drive down to North Carolina to work for the summer. And I was by myself, and I turned on the radio, probably not for 4 or 5 hours into the trip. I think that's how much I was really just kind of out of it, that I wasn't even listening to anything. And just drove the car, and then I clicked it on somewhere in the middle of West Virginia. And I remember a legendary sports announcer, a guy named Don Cricky, who did basically like a sports radio update for NBC affiliates across the country. And he had made some comment about, you know, last night in the National League West, so-and-so jumped over so-and-so to go into first place. Now, for a lot of people, it's hard to believe that that's where you would be getting your primary information about anything anymore, because this is long before cell phones, long before the internet, long before any of that kind of thing. So, you know, almost all the information that people back in those days were getting was from, you know, the television or the radio. And I remember thinking, man, this is the first time in my life that I can ever recall where I kind of didn't know what was going on in sports. And I thought, you know, I've grown up around this my whole life. I really like kind of knowing what's going on. I like being a part of it, as I had been in our household growing up all those years. And I got to North Carolina, and I called my dad on the phone, and I said, hey, you know, do you know anybody at the local Reds affiliate in Athens, Ohio, where I was going to school, that might need, you know, some kind of help around the radio station, because that could be my job and I can make some money and all that kind of thing. And he called the guy up on the phone, a fellow named Dave Palmer, who owned the station in Athens, Ohio, and said, hey, are you looking for anything? He said, look, I can't do anything for him on the air. He said, but I can, you know, have him doing a bunch of logging of albums, and, you know, back in those days when there were albums. And so I started to go to work for the station when I got back. And, you know, one thing led to another. Well, all of a sudden, the next thing I know is, you know, in a town like that, you'll have a lot of people that are coming sort of in and out, students and that kind of thing. And then they'll get their first job in this town or that town. And so the next thing you know, I end up on the air. Next thing you know, I'm doing I'm DJing at night on an FM station and spinning records from 10 o'clock at night until 1 o'clock in the morning. And then it kind of moved into a talk show. And long story short, you know, I got a chance to finally start doing some play-by-play for the Ohio University women's basketball team. And really, that's where it all, you know, kind of took off from there.
I see. That's where it began. Well, that's quite a journey. And this journey would extend all the way to the Chicago Cubs organization, where you were associated with Harry Carey.
Yep. And, you know, it was, you know, getting to that point was really, I think I look back on it, and, you know, there's certain people in your life that you never, you know, you always feel like you're forgetting people when you start talking about things like this. But, you know, I'll never forget. I was getting ready to graduate from college, and it was my senior year. And it was right around Christmas time. It was my grandparents' 50th anniversary, and they were having a roast for my dad in Cincinnati. And it was quite a to-do to raise money for charity. And they had everybody from Sparky Anderson to Johnny Bench to Pete Rose to Skip Carey to Bob Costas to Bobby Knight, all these guys who were speakers of this roast. And the fellow who ran the thing asked me, said, hey, look, could we surprise your dad, have you come back from college and be the last speaker at this roast? And so I got up there, said a few words. The program was over, and I was sort of hanging out with my grandparents afterwards in a huge ballroom and couple thousand people there, whatever it was. And this really tall, handsome, broad-shouldered, older man comes walking up to me, and he says, hey, I understand that New York accent, tough guy, you know, walks up to me and says, I understand you're taking a radio job in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, when you graduate from college here in a few months. And I said, yes, sir, I am. He said, well, I think that's the biggest blanking mistake you've ever made in your life. And I looked at him, I'm like, is that right? I don't even know who this guy is. And he introduces himself. His name is Tony Kiernan, and he was a general manager of Channel 5 WLWT, the NBC affiliate in Cincinnati, which had the Reds games on television at the time. And he said, I think you ought to come to work for me. And I said, well, doing what? He said, well, I'm not going to put you on the air right away. You got to earn your stripes. He said, but I think you ought to be in television and not going to work in radio in North Carolina. Why not start in Cincinnati? So that's exactly what I did. And then, you know, again, as the years sort of went by, and there were a number of years there where I was off the air, got a chance to be on the air. You know, Lord works in mysterious ways. All of a sudden, the guy who's a weekend sports anchor at the time gets in a fight with a weatherman, not on the air, but off the air. And they need somebody to be the weekend anchor. I became the weekend anchor. They had the Reds games. They didn't want their Monday through Friday sportscaster doing the Reds games because it was too important, they thought, for the ratings to have him missing so much time. So they asked me to fill in the first year in 1988 for about 10 or 12 games, got the job full-time in 89. And then in 1990, the postseason opened up. And I really did not think I had any chance whatsoever. In fact, I did not tell anyone, not my mom, not my dad. I didn't tell anybody that I was even going to apply for the job because I knew there was no way that was going to happen. They would have so many people apply for that job who were far better announcers with far more experience. Well, as it turns out, they were looking for somebody really young who, you know, good Lord willing, you do a good job, you could be around there for 35 or 40 years, because that had been kind of the MO of announcers at that time, especially in Chicago. And so I wound up getting a job there, and you know, it was still to this day the biggest shock. I can't even still believe it happened, and that's 30 years ago.
That's amazing to realize just, you know, how this affects that, and what opportunity can lead to another opportunity. And like you said, you had decisions to make. You know, you could go back to North Carolina, do radio, or stay here in Cincinnati. So it's just amazing how all that can work out over time. And eventually, you would become the first television broadcaster for the Arizona Diamondbacks.
Yeah, I was with the Cubs, and I had been there for 6 years, and the Fox Network had started up. And I had been given an incredible opportunity with them the first year. They got the rights to the National Football League going back to 1994. And so, for the last 2 years, I was missing weekends in September of the Cubs to go do NFL games for Fox. Well, the Tribune Company, who owned the Cubs and owned WGN, they really didn't like that idea much of missing games. And so we just kind of agreed to disagree that, maybe it's time for me to try to find another job in baseball out there. And I had made some connections in spring training with people who were starting the Arizona Diamondbacks franchise. And Jerry Colangelo's in the NBA and the Basketball Hall of Fame. He was the owner of the Phoenix Suns at the time. He was the primary guy who was putting the money up to bring a baseball franchise to Phoenix. He was from Chicago originally. And so he still watched a lot of Cubs games on TV on WGN. So he was somewhat familiar with my work. And so when he learned that I was leaving the Cubs, he had called me in the winter of 1995 and said, I'd like you to fly out here and just talk to me about, you know, a little bit about the TV and radio. And they weren't starting to play until 1998. And so I'm thinking to myself, you know, all right, I'll go out to Arizona, have a conversation with this guy. Boy, it's just going to be cool to really be around him for a few hours. And the day I met him, 7 hours later, 2 years before the team started playing, I was the announcer for the Arizona Diamondbacks. And, you know, I've said it before and I'll say it again, you know, the Lord works in mysterious ways. I mean, again, that was without a doubt, it was meant to be for me professionally, but far more importantly, because, you know, I was one of the first 20 people that got hired by that franchise. Well, one of the other 20 people is the woman that I'm married to now, thank God, for 18 years. And we got married there and our children were born there and baptized there. And it was the best move professionally, personally, that there could have ever been was going to Arizona.
Absolutely. The best move ever. When you have those kind of results, you couldn't ask for anything better.
No.
I will tell you this, though, Tom, in a selfish way, is that when I knew that you were with the Diamondbacks, I was going, I tell you what, I sure wish he was here in Cincinnati. So just so you know, I was already anticipating your arrival here. And arrive you
well,
did.
Well, I appreciate it.
Well, you are most welcome. And when you first arrived, I believe that you had joined your father a lot in the radio booth. Was that correct? When you first arrived here,
yes,
as an announcer?
And that was the goal when I was given that opportunity by the Castellini family to come to Cincinnati, was that that I would have a chance to do about 40 games a year on the radio with my dad. And then, you know, in subsequent years, what happened was is George Grand was a primary television announcer for the team, and he decided to retire. And so the franchise had asked me about moving from radio, those games on the radio, and going over to the television side. And so it's been that way really ever since.
Absolutely. And the rest, as they say, is history. And you've been teamed up with various individuals, of course, over the years, some outstanding announcers in their own right. And many of them have been former Reds players, which makes it even sweeter. Chris Welsh would be one. I always enjoy listening to him. I wanted to ask you what it was like to work with Chris.
Oh, he's just a terrific analyst. He knows the game inside and out. He's a former pitcher in the major leagues. He was born and raised, or not born, but he was raised in Cincinnati. Went to St. Xavier High School, so he grew up a big fan of the Reds like you did, like I did, and he just knows the game inside and out. And he also knows television. You know, that's the one thing that I think that is frequently missed when people say, you know, I think this guy should go in the television booth after his playing days are finished. It's one thing to know the game and to be able to talk about the game. It's another thing to know television. And, you know, the timing of it and when you should get in, when you should get out, somebody talking in your ear, telling you, you know, what the replay and what angle it's coming from while you're trying to describe it. And so, you know, that's one thing where I've been just so blessed for so long, going all the way back to the Cubs days, whether it was the analyst of Bob Brenly and Ron Santo and Steve Stone, but the Diamondbacks, Bob Brenly again, Steve Lyons, and Jim Traber, and then coming to the Reds and being with Chris Welsh and Jeff Brantley. These guys have become professional television announcers. Yes, they're former players, but they've become professional TV announcers. And those are the ones that get it and understand it. And you're all in it together to try and achieve, you know, the best possible presentation of whatever event you're doing to the fans who have taken the time to invite you into their home to watch it.
Absolutely. And you know what? The one thing I really enjoy about Chris is, of course, being a former pitcher. Boy, I love his descriptions of pitches. Like in a certain important situation, he'll explain to the viewer, you know, this is probably why he threw it, or this is not where he intended to locate that pitch. And I love to hear a good description on pitching like that. And like you said, Tom, you know, he brings that pass skill to his broadcasting and so very well. And I wanted to ask you about another gentleman, former Reds pitcher, and that is Jeff Brantley. And I have to tell you, Tom, when I first heard Jeff on the radio, and I actually heard his first day, believe it or not, it just happened to work out that way, I was very taken aback by his calmness and the way he presented himself, because when that man pitched, he was an absolute bulldog.
Oh, you're 100% correct. And you know, he's still very much that same bulldog. Don't let the calmness or the front sort of kind of thing, and I don't mean he's putting on some facade, but I mean, don't let that fool you. He is still very intense. He's an ultimate professional. He wants to be great, not good. Every time he took the ball as a pitcher, and the same thing as a broadcaster. And again, another guy, as you just described, that he just knows pitching inside and out, understands situations. You know, what a pitcher's thinking out there on the mound. I mean, you know, those two guys, when it comes to talking about pitching, it's just extraordinary, the knowledge. They've forgotten more than most of us who have announced for 30 plus years will ever know.
Absolutely. And your dad, you know, it's one thing for an announcer to say, oh, you know what, I don't think this guy's very good. Well, that's not really, you know, that's really not adding too much to the commentary. Your dad, though, takes the approach that if someone is going to trot the first base and the game is tied, and because he trotted, let's say the third baseman dropped the ball and he's still thrown out, your dad will call him out and say, well, if he would have hustled, he would have made it.
Yep.
And I think that's what makes your dad so special, is he does have a sense of honesty in his broadcasting, but he does it from his heart and with love for the game.
Well, there's no doubt. And unfortunately, the state of broadcasting today, and I've said this many, many times, and having the blessing of working with Billy Carey for 6 years in Chicago, who is very much a similar kind of announcer as my dad, you know, they're not hiring those guys anymore in this business. And I think it's really sad. I think that everything has become so vanilla. It's become so much about cheerleading. Look, I mean, nobody wants the Reds to win more than my dad, but at the same time, as you just described, there are situations that occur, and look, nobody's perfect. I mean, the only guy who was perfect, they put him up on a cross and they crucified him, right? So I mean, nobody's perfect, but you know, there are times that you owe it to, I think, the people who are listening to be honest. And it doesn't mean you go out of your way to beat up somebody personally or take issue with them personally. But, you know, in this day and age in broadcasting, you are hard pressed to find anybody who will describe what you just described the way my dad did or does, or Harry Carey did, or people like that. They just don't, you know, whether it's television executives or executives at different major league baseball teams, regardless of sport, really, they want somebody who's up there pretty much cheerleading the entire time. And I really think it's taken away from the color of the relationship between the broadcaster and the fan.
I completely 100% agree with you, and that's what makes your dad, to me, extra special. I'm not going to name any names because that would be very inappropriate of me, but just to give an example, Tom, I listened to some broadcasters from other organizations. They were fine. Nothing wrong with them. But it was just what you described. I was really taken aback of how vanilla, how, like you said, cheerleaders, there was no extra layer to what was really happening. And to be honest, I'm not a man that gets bored easily, but I just found it completely uninteresting compared to the style of your dad. And you're right. It's a shame that there's not more situations allowed for broadcasters these days, because you're right. There's a lot of cheerleaders out there, and that's pretty much all they do.
Yeah, well, that's all they're being asked to do. You know, and in fairness, you know, when you talk about my dad being able to do that, you know, it's a two-way street, meaning that you know, the franchise has always given him a lot of room to do that.
I mean, you know, absolutely.
Both franchises, you know, do something like that, you can get away with it once or twice or maybe three times, and the next thing you know is you're out of a job. So, you know, as much credit is given to somebody like my dad for quote-unquote telling it like it is, I think there's a lot of credit that needs to be given to the Reds for allowing him to tell it like it is.
Absolutely. The very classy organization, the Cincinnati Reds. Thank you for pointing that out, that it's a two-way street. And Tom, if you don't mind me just asking about a few particular players, just a few and a few selected memories, and that would be just in general – your thoughts on the Big Red Machine as a team, because let me tell you, for those who didn't see them, they were a force to be reckoned with, no doubt about it.
Well, I mean, you could sit around and debate, you know, from now until the end of time about, you know, what was the greatest team in the history of baseball. And you know, you hear the 27 Yankees, you hear the 76, 75 Reds. Those are the two that really, I think, come to the forefront for most people who have really studied and watched the game and you know, studied the history of the game. It's hard for me to imagine, and I did not see the 1927 New York Yankees play. It's hard to imagine, and I think the key word you used there was team. I mean, they were made up of the greatest collection of individual stars at basically every position there was on the field. From a straight physical standpoint, you couldn't afford that team today. Not even the Yankees or the Red Sox or the Cubs. Or the Dodgers, none of those could afford that team in this day and age. I mean, you had the, you know, the all-time hits leader playing third base. You had the nine-time all-star shortstop. You had the two-time most valuable player, 12-time all-star second baseman, Hall of Famer both at third, at short, or what will be one day at short, Hall of Famer at second, Tony Perez, Hall of Famer at first, arguably the greatest catcher in the history of the game, Johnny Bench behind the plate. Yes. In left field, you had George Foster, National League Most Valuable Player, 52 home runs. Center fielder, Cesar Geronimo, five-time Gold Glove winner. Right fielder, Ken Griffey Sr., over 2,700 career hits. You didn't afford that team anymore. But they were the ultimate team, and they just found ways to beat you every single day. Even if it took doing the little things like hitting a ground ball to the right side to move a runner from second to third, a fly ball to drive a runner in, they were just an extraordinary group that it was amazing to be old enough to really remember how good they were.
And they were smart players, just like you said. They knew how to get the job done, hit it over to, like you said, you know, the third base, get a bunt down, move a man over. But you know what sticks out of my mind, Tom, is this like old school approach to the game combined with extra efforts. It seemed like everybody on that team, their helmets were flying off all over the place, or their hats, because they were getting dirty and they were going to get the job done as a team.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what they were. You know, you hear the term a lot now. I don't think it was used much back then, of baseball IQ. And, you know, it didn't matter whether it was Tony Perez from Cuba, Davey Concepcion from Venezuela, Joe Morgan from Oakland, California, Pete Rose from Cincinnati, fill in the blanks, Johnny Bench from Bangor, Oklahoma. These guys were well-schooled in baseball, not only as youth, but when they came through the Reds organization, about what it took to win. And they wanted to play every day. The backup players rarely ever played because those guys wanted to be in the lineup each and every day. It was and really still is, because all those guys are still alive, thank God, of the guys that we've talked about anyway and mentioned by name. And they're still a very special, special group. It's hard to believe, you know, that whole group now is getting into their you know, mid-70s, late-70s, early-80s.
That is hard to believe. It really is, no doubt about it. And one more thought on Johnny Bench. One thing that sticks out in my mind is that, you know, he often was, you know, taking that catcher's mask off if there was a play at the plate. Also, a phenomenal hitter. And I think that his presence behind the plate, I remember the way he kind of moved around his knees and, you know, it just, to me, the finest catcher the game has ever seen. But I'm just wondering, I don't see catchers throwing off that mask anymore. I no doubt safety is the top priority, but I wonder what it was about that time where catchers like him or Gary Carter, they just flipped that mask off and they were waiting for the runner.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different game. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And, you know, I mean, I think a lot of the changes are very good for the game. You know, Buster Posey a few years ago, outstanding catcher for the Giants, is involved in a home plate collision, breaks his ankle. Well, you know, I don't think that's good for anybody. It's not good for him, obviously. It's not good for a fan of the San Francisco Giants. It's not good for baseball. So, you know, the reasons for it are certainly understandable in all sports. Football has changed a great deal along with baseball. But, you know, back in those days, you're right, there was and it's not to suggest that the catchers today, because many of them don't like some of the new rules. They would prefer they'd be more like the old school rules. But I think at the end of the day, you know, you look back on those guys and you have tremendous admiration. The equipment wasn't as good as it is now. But they just had a toughness that was just anybody who catches, even in this day and age, those guys who play that position, they're just incredibly tough men.
No doubt about it. They sure are. And I know that when I played sports myself back in school or even in a softball league, Tom, it's interesting how the inspiration from those guys, because I would go up to the plate going, I'm going to give it everything I have. And so, you know, I have to kind of tip my hat to them for their inspiration all these years later. And I wanted to ask you about another outstanding Reds player. And to be honest, Tom, one of my all-time favorites. And I will tell you this, no matter how good the Reds were a particular season going in or not as good, as long as he was there healthy and in the lineup, I always felt hope. And that is Barry Larkin. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on him as a Cincinnati Reds player.
Just an extraordinary player. You know, he's in the Hall of Fame for a reason. I mean, this guy was blessed with just incredible athleticism, unbelievable intelligence, great leadership. I mean, he was the whole package. You know, I'm not sure that any of those players on the Big Red Machine outside of maybe Joe Morgan, that you could categorize the way that I just described Larkin. He was so savvy. He was so smart. He was so polished. He was so extraordinary, athletic and gifted and blessed and just a winner, played with great passion and fire. You know, I think of all, I look back on all the Reds players, the one I think that I enjoyed watching the most through his career, but for a lot of his career, I had left and I was already announcing whether it was the Cubs or the Diamondbacks games. But whenever I have the opportunity to watch Larkin, I'm still not so sure that he's not the favorite player to watch play. I remember one game that will forever stand out in my mind was when I was announcing the Cubs games and the Reds were at Wrigley Field playing in Chicago. Four times in the same game, and I don't know if I've ever seen this just happen, period, much less what happened subsequently, was all four times that Larkin came to the plate in the game that night, there was a runner at second base and nobody out. And all four times he had ground balls to the second baseman and moved a runner over to third. Now, he goes in the book as 0-for-4, and this is one of the great players in the history of baseball, one of the greatest shortstops to ever play.
And on that night, if you looked in the box score the next day and saw he went 0-for-4, you'd say, oh, Larkin didn't do anything last night. He single-handedly helped his team win a game without getting a hit, never getting on base. And that just tells you about his unselfishness and his leadership and his desire to beat the opponent. He was an incredible player.
He sure was, and you described him perfectly, the essence of what made Barry Larkin a great player. And one of the reasons I miss him every year. Every year I go, well, you know, Barry Larkin is not going to be there in spring training, especially the last few years. But it took me a while to get that out of my head because I was like, hey, the Reds are coming back. And it's like, well, Barry Larkin has retired. But
yeah.
Very, very wonderful description of him. And it reminds me of a team that he was involved with. I just thought I'd get your opinion on this team. And that is the 99 Cincinnati Reds. Lots of young players, probably not really expected to do too much. And wow, even though they didn't get as far as they had hoped. What an incredible, exciting year. And I still remember at the end of the year, them sweeping the Cardinals 4 straight games at home. And they had that mishap with the Brewers, the final game that kind of, put a sour into the ending of the season. But I have to tell you, what an amazing team when I think back to the 99 Reds.
Well, it really was, and they came out of nowhere, and, I was not announcing for the team that particular season. I saw them a number of times play, but was not announcing their games, but they were the ultimate team. They had some great stars on that team. There's no doubt about that. They had Greg Vaughn. They had brought in as a free agent, had a monster year for them out in left field and became a real leader along with Barry Larkin, but, you know, they were a team, and you're right. They fell short that last weekend, and then they had the one-game playoff, and they were beaten by the Mets and Al Leiter at Riverfront Stadium, and I think the stadium on a Sunday night because the Brewers game the night before that would determine whether or not they had to play the one-game playoff. Tickets didn't go on sale, I don't think, until like 11:30 Eastern time, and they were sold out in 40 minutes the next afternoon for a game, the one-game playoff, and they were shut out by Al Leiter and the Mets. But, that was a really, really exciting team to watch.
It sure was, and all those home runs from Vaughn, I'll tell you, it was something else. I did want to ask you your thoughts on a group of pitchers. I don't think we've really seen the likes of this ever since. And that was Glavin, Smoltz, and Maddux. And then if you throw in Steve Avery, I mean, wasn't it amazing to see those guys come out and pitch? Because, I mean, you took so much effort to really beat them.
Well, it did. And, you know, during the regular season, you really didn't beat them much when you go in and play them in a 3 or 4-game series. You know, you were in big trouble facing those guys. I always found it very interesting, and it's not to take away anything because they're all 3 Hall of Famers in Maddux and Smoltz and Glavin. You know, Smoltz of those 3 was really the only one, though, that once all those Atlanta Braves teams got into the playoffs, it really excelled in the postseason. It's not to say that Glavin or Maddux wouldn't pitch a good game here or there, but they weren't the same pitchers in the postseason as they were in the regular season. Now, they were playing very good teams once you got to the World Series, that's for sure. But to think that they went to the playoffs, what, 12 or 13 straight years, and they only won 1 World Series. It's really hard to believe. But they were incredible to watch. I saw Maddux when I got the Cubs job in 1990. And for the next 4 years, he was with Chicago and then left as a free agent to go to Atlanta. And the rest is history. But even watching him go from a very, very young pitcher who lost 18 games his first full year in the major leagues to becoming one of the great pitchers of all time, he was just an incredible pitcher. To watch the evolution of Greg Maddux from being so young and so raw to becoming almost, a professor like out there on the mound. He was just incredible to watch.
You just described it well, professor, because I remember, and I wish I could remember who it was. Someone said when I was watching a game of the Braves many years ago, and they said that if Maddux gets burnt by a hitter, let's say they get a long ball on him on an account, he'll never throw that pitch again in that situation to that guy. And I find that amazing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he knew he could tell you even today if you had a conversation with him, he could tell you, you know, he gave up a home run to fill in the blank on a 2-1 count in Cincinnati back in 1995. And he'll tell you, well, you know, the next 7 times I saw that guy, I got to 2-1 and I threw X instead of Y. He was incredible.
He sure was. And thank you for sharing your thoughts on that. And we get to our Cincinnati Reds this season here in 2018. Well, we had a slow start. Obviously, you could say more or less we are in a rebuilding phase of the organization. But lo and behold, Tom, as you well know, these Cincinnati Reds turn things around. And I'll tell you what, every now and then a team can get on a lucky streak. Okay, we've all seen that over the years. I'm sure you have. But this really wasn't a lucky streak. This was a team that was going out there playing like they were in first place. I mean, they were coming back from games. It could be the ninth inning, two outs, and they would find a way to beat you. The pitching was getting the job done. Great big hitting rallies. It was absolutely amazing. And I remember newspaper organizations just a month ago or so, they were all mentioning the Reds like, wow, this is amazing. Showing a lot of respect. Well, lo and behold, Tom, the All-Star break comes. And I wanted to ask you, not to make an excuse, but my heart basically was like, oh no, because I had a feeling that it was going to change things. And it did. Because what is it about the All-Star break when you are having so much momentum and then it arrives and then you go and try to pick it up and it just doesn't come back, does it, at times?
Yeah, I mean, I think that can happen both ways, Stephen, to be honest with you. I think there are teams that have great momentum, then all of a sudden that All-Star break comes around and it takes away the momentum that they had started to build for an extended period of time. And then I think there are some teams that are not playing well at the break. Maybe guys are getting tired, whatever the case may be. They get that 4 or 5 day All-Star break and they're rejuvenated afterwards and all of a sudden their season will take flight. So, you know, it just all depends, I think, on any given year, how your team kind of finishes in front of it and, you know, then what happens yes. subsequently behind it. I don't think there have been any great studies that have ever been done on it to try to explain, you know, why this happens, why would that happen? But, you know, with the Reds, I think it was more of a case of injuries more than necessarily just coming out flat after the All-Star break. They had played so well for the better part of, you know, 2 months after that horrific start to the year where they were 20 games under 500. And then all of a sudden they go 21-9 in June. They play great in July, and you know, and then the next thing you know, players start dropping, and they lose two very good bats in their lineup. And rookie Jesse Winker was having a nice year, and Scott Schebler was really playing well. They had moved him into the leadoff spot. The pitchers were on a pretty good roll, but then you know Winker goes out for the season, Schebler goes out for the next month. The pitchers all of a sudden aren't pitching the way they were. You probably use more bullpen than you wanted to use the first half of the season, so those guys are kind of run down, and now you start to get exposed a little bit for some of the shortcomings you had when the season began. It's not to say they haven't had some individual players that have not had just extraordinary seasons, like Eugenio Suarez and Scooter Jeanette, among others, but there also have been a lot of guys that have not played the way you thought they would play when the season began.
Well, and we have a new manager here in Cincinnati, Jim Riggleman, and a former manager of the Cubs. I remember many, many years ago. Boy, he just has the makeup of a manager, doesn't he? I look at him and I go, there's a manager.
Yeah, he really does. There's no doubt. You just hit the nail on the head. There's a manager. He is a professional baseball manager. He will not be outmaneuvered. It's not to say his team's going to execute all the time and do the things that he wants them to do. That's just not going to happen for any manager. But when it comes to being able to look ahead an inning or two in this situation or that situation or what to do in this spot or that spot, he is totally on his game. Now, whether or not he ends up being a long-term manager, I don't think anybody knows the answer to that question, including the owner of the team as we're doing this interview today. But he has done an excellent job, and I'm really glad they've given him this opportunity.
I sure am, too. He's done an excellent job, as you said, and I'm very proud of those Reds for that wonderful winning streak. That was so much fun. And just a final few questions for you, Tom. There is a current Cincinnati Reds player I would love to know your thoughts on, and that is a gentleman that when I think of him, I think of the all-around baseball player, and that is Joey Votto.
Oh, there's no question. I think that that Votto's career, it's interesting, you know, how you view the game and how you view players. He's kind of been the eye of the storm of that whole sort of changing, if you will, or at least debate inside of baseball about what's more important. You know, are they statistics like home runs and runs batted in and batting average, or are they statistics based on batting average, on base percentage, slugging percentage, you know, all those kinds of things. I think if you use the latter statistics, he probably would be the greatest offensive player in the history of the Reds franchise before his career is over. He certainly is,
you know, he has his, he's very much a lightning rod, I think, between the old school and the new school line of thinking as a baseball player. Yes. And his value to a baseball team. But that's no fault of his. I mean, you know, his simple answer to any question is what's your ultimate goal? And he says it's to not make out. And so, you know, when you stop and think about it, as simplistic as that is, but it's so true, is that when you're getting paid to play baseball, your job as a hitter is to get on base, however that may be. And so nobody in the history of the Reds franchise has been better than Votto in that regard. Now, has he hit as many home runs as some other guys? No. Has he not hit as many runs as some other guys? No. You know, has his defense and base running declined as the years have gone on? Yes, but that's going to happen to any player. But from a straight offensive standpoint, it's hard to believe that when all is said and done and when his career is over, that you could say definitively there was a better offensive player in the history of the Reds franchise than Joey Votto.
I completely agree. One of the finest, and I liked your description, old school meets modern. That's how I think of Joey. I see a lot of old school.
It's going to come down to what they get from the Hall of Fame. It's going to come down to that. And a lot of the voters, when that day comes around, say in 10 or 15 years from now, they're going to be a different generation of voters, just like different generation of players that put more stock in some of the stats I mentioned a moment ago. And they're going to say, okay, Votto's a Hall of Fame player. But when you start comparing, say, if he does go in the Hall of Fame, his statistics in terms of home runs and runs batted in and things like that, he's not going to be in the same galaxy as some of the guys that are already in the Hall of Fame. You know, you're going to have those guys that have, you know, 400 or 500 home runs, that have 1,400 or 1,500 or more than that runs batted in. Votto will come nowhere close to those kinds of numbers before his career is finished.
Outstanding player, and he wears the uniform with a lot of pride, and you know, we all appreciate him here in Cincinnati. Now, your father, Tom, unless he has changed his perspective, and I'm unaware of it, there is a debate of the DH arriving, you know, into the National League like it is in the American League. Well, I side with your father. It's enough to just have me very concerned. Nothing against the DH. I understand what the philosophy is. Why have a pitcher bat when you can have a guy maybe at the end of his career that can still hit but maybe can't play like he used to or have some more offense? But I have to tell you this. The thing I like about not having the DH is the strategy. You bring in the DH and you don't have the moves with pitchers. And what if the pitcher is going to bat in the next inning and leading off? Do you leave him in the game or do you bring in a pinch hitter? You take away all of that if you don't have the pitcher bat. But I wanted to get your personal opinion on that.
Well, you know, look, subject. All I do is, Stephen, all I do is I really, you know, just sort of, you know, hand off that sort of topic, if you will, to people who have actually done both in a managerial role. And the two people would be Sparky Anderson and Tony La Russa. And both of them are concrete and very forthright. You know, God rest his soul, Sparky, but Tony La Russa even now in saying that, look, you know, it's not to take away anything from other American League managers, but a monkey could manage in that league. I mean, there's just no strategy or decisions like you're talking about. You know, you're in a 1-1 game, you're in the eighth inning, your pitcher's pitching a great game, the first two batters in the inning get on, are you going to hit for them? You know, all those kinds of things, which you just, even in an American League game, there's no decision, not to worry about it. It never comes to that. It's not a matter of not making a decision, you don't have to even make one. And so, you know, I would like to think that those guys, you know, would know more about it than I ever will. And if their word is that they like the game without the DH better than the game with the DH, and that's good enough for me.
I hear you, because I feel if you wear the uniform and you're on the field and it's your turn to bat, you either bat or you'll have to be removed from the game and someone else take your place. So
that's right.
I love that description. Thank you. I mean, very much. Thank you. And my final thoughts is, you know, rebuilding is obviously a big part of baseball. I have noticed over the years that some organizations say we are rebuilding, but then next year they say, well, it didn't go as we suspected, so we're actually starting now. And then guess what, Tom? Yeah. The third year, they do that. To me, rebuilding is going, we have a plan, and yes, there's going to be some bumps and surprises, but we have a plan that in maybe 3 years, we're going to be at this level. And the Pirates come to mind because it seemed like for year after year, they were just rebuilding. And then they would trade away players, and it never really felt like rebuilding. So what's your thought on the current situation of the Cincinnati Reds? It seems like they have a lot of talented young players. And do you think things are headed in the right direction at the moment?
Well, I think that's all going to depend, Steve, on how these young pitchers come along. You know, we heard so much about the talent level of these young guys as they were coming up through the minor leagues. And look, being a young pitcher in the major leagues is no easy task. And trying to navigate your way through the lineup the second, the third time, all that sort of thing. But to answer your question, the rebuild and the schedule of the rebuild will only go as far as how well those guys pitch. And so far, unfortunately, in the last 2 years for the Reds franchise, these guys they were really counting on to be good pitchers have not been consistently good pitchers. They've had some bad luck with some health issues. But by and large, the guys that they really were counting on have been in good health, and they just have not pitched consistently well enough to put your team in a position to make dramatic steps forward. You know, you might see like Tyler Mahle earlier this year, a very talented young pitcher with a great promise to his future. And in the month of June, he had the lowest earned run average of any pitcher in the National League. By the third week in July, he's back in the minor league because he can't get me out. So, you know, it's been very trying and very tough for those people who are making those decisions about, you know, where do we go from here? Are you going to reach the end of the season this year where there are four or five of those young pitchers who are still don't know what we have here. We thought we knew what we have, but it's not playing out that way. Is it going to happen next year, or are you going to have to turn somewhere else? So it's a tricky business to being able to do it. There's no doubt about it, and I don't think there's any blueprint for it to be able to get it done definitively.
It does take a while. There's no doubt about it.
Yes.
And you described it just perfectly, Tom. Thank you. And my final question to you today, and first of all, I have just enjoyed myself very, very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And when I really love afternoon games, if I'm there on a Sunday afternoon and I'm looking out over the ballpark, there's just so many thoughts that enter my mind. Like we discussed, Barry Larkin and the history of the game. I think that's the beautiful thing about baseball. It kind of stays with you. When you go into the booth, you know, what feelings or thoughts do you experience from time to time?
Well, they're the same sort of thing. I mean, you know, I'm no different than you are. I mean, there are days I think you get a little more melancholy than perhaps some other days. You know, a lot of it might depend on what's going on in your life or you know, how are your kids doing or anything happening home and, you know, all those kinds of things. And so, you know, that's where I think we forget sometimes with baseball players that they're real people, too. And have the same kinds of issues that the rest of us have. They might have more money than the rest of us, but it doesn't mean that they still don't have some sort of things that they have on their mind when they show up at the ballpark. But, you know, it's a great game. I think it's got a lot of warts right now. I think that the pace of play is awful. I think that with all the night games and the very late night games for the better part of two or three generations now, that we've lost some of the younger generation fans. And I know that the commissioner feels like that's very important to try and find a way to turn the tide on that topic. And so, you know, hopefully they'll start to address some things moving forward that will, I think, make it a more appealing game to younger people whose attention span, you know, continues to shrink in society because of devices and phones and computers and all that kind of thing. And hopefully baseball, you know, can figure out some ways to make the game a little bit better because I think it needs some help right now.
I hear you. And Tom, I just want to say that if your partner, Chris or Jeff would like to take an extra day off, maybe go golfing or something, and you need someone to fill in, just give me a call.
That'd be a good deal. I'd enjoy that. We'd love to have you up there.
I would too. Sure would be a dream come true in many ways. Well, this is host Stephen Brittingham wanting to thank my guest, Tom Brenneman. Tom, thank you for being such a special guest today.
Thank you for having me, Stephen. My pleasure.
And to all the listeners out there, while my guest, Tom Brenneman, may have followed in his dad's footsteps, one thing is for sure is that he's brought his own unique style to his broadcasting. And I just want to say that this has been a huge honor. I think so highly of Tom and his father and of the Cincinnati Reds organization. Well, this is host Stephen Brittingham, and I'll see you on another episode of Hollywood and Beyond. Thank you. Hi, friends and listeners. This is host Stephen Brittingham. Do you happen to have a question or a comment for me? Or perhaps you feel that you might make an interesting guest here on Hollywood and Beyond. Whatever your reason may be, please feel free to contact me anytime directly at the show's official email address. That would be hollywoodandbeyondshow@gmail.com. That is hollywoodandbeyondshow@gmail.com. I look forward to hearing from you soon.